The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
So let's go over to John 4 and see if we can get through some of this today. After this experience, Christ moved over from Judea to Galilee with his ministry. In chapter 4 and verse 1 through 3, it says, "When the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples baptized, he left Judea and parted again into Galilee." Now, why do you think Jesus wouldn't baptize? Think for a minute about this. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians 1. 1 Corinthians 1. You can kind of see this, that Jesus wouldn't necessarily baptize people himself. I think because, could you imagine the opportunity for conflict, for people feeling, "I'm superior to you because I was baptized by Jesus"? And so what he did was he just had his disciples baptized so that it would level the playing field in one sense, and I think eliminate a lot of conflict. But let me give you an example here, what was going on in Corinth. And it didn't take long for division to develop within the church over these very kinds of issues. In verse 10 of 1 Corinthians 1, it says, "Now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment." And then he says, "But it's been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that there are contentions among you. Now this I say, that every one of you says, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas, or I'm of Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you, or were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you except for Crispus and Gaius." See, so even Paul, because of, you know, didn't want to get into this kind of stuff, you can see. So anyway, I think that there's reason to think that Jesus probably decided that he wouldn't baptize people personally, because it could be a problem for people who he had baptized. Then why did he move his ministry? You know, I think he did so, it says clearly, to avoid confrontation with the Pharisees, that he knew that his ministry now was eclipsing that of John's, and that he was really going to become more of a threat to the Pharisees, and they were questioning him all the time. And so they had already questioned John, and they would probably soon be coming to Christ. And of course, Jesus had thrown out the money changers and all of that, so he was very much suspect by them. And so he would move out of the way and move his headquarters, as it were, up into Galilee. And also, I think another reason is because it helps spread things around when you can preach in one area and then go preach to another area. I know I had suggested this to one of the larger groups once, and they turned it down because they want to be on one of the large cables. But if my suggestion was this, is if you went into Chicago and blanketed Chicago for 6 months, and went into New York and blanketed New York for 6 months, and went into a different like Los Angeles and blanketed them, I thought it would do a lot better. I actually think we'd be far more successful in preaching the gospel. But there's a certain element of I guess feeling good about being on one of the large stations and so on, that kind of thing. So anyway, I believe this too, there's that he was moved by the Spirit to do this. So back to John 4 and verse 4. In order to go back to Galilee, which would finally be his headquarters, and you can see him doing this because in Jerusalem, that's where the rulers were. That's where the people who were threatened were. So about the farthest you could get away, it was in the south. About the farthest you could get away was over into Galilee. And the Galileans were a different group of people, and so I think he moved there to do that. But on the way, there was an area he had to pass through. In verse 4, it says, "And he must needs go through Samaria." Now, the whole area of Palestine is about 120 miles long, is all it is. And Judea is on the south. And Galilee, of course, is up at the north. And then in between was this broad expanse called Samaria. And this was an interesting place because the Samaritans, as you read in the Bible, were just rejected by the Jews. They were hated and despised. There was this continual hostility between the two. The Jews felt superior. Let's go over to John 8 for a minute, to the Samaritans. And there's an example of this here. So if you were going to call somebody a name today, you know, you can think of what we might call someone today and some of the worst names you could call someone in our world today. Well, what would be the worst thing you could call someone in their community? The worst thing you could call them would be a Samaritan. That's actually what they called Christ. John 8 here and verse 48, you see this example of the view that they had. Jesus had said that you don't hear God's words because you're not of God. Then answered the Jews to him, and they said, "Say we not well that you're a Samaritan and that you have a devil?" You see, they were really, that's about the worst put down you could say to somebody. But I think it's valuable to understand why there was this hostility before we look at this woman who was a Samaritan. What was going on here between these peoples? Well, the Samaritans held the territory that was once held by the 10 tribes of Israel. There were at one time 12 tribes. Those two the 12 tribes split after Solomon, and they went to war. And Israel, were the 10 tribes to the north, went to war with Judah down in the south. And they split and became different peoples here. Well, what happened was, these 10 tribes that went up north, in order to keep the loyalty of the people, they changed the holy days and the place of worship from Jerusalem to Bethel and Dan. And there they put these golden calves there, and they began to worship and so on. And so they had become very corrupt after a while and had deteriorated spiritually after some time. And they reached their low point, as you remember, under Ahab and Jezebel. And they were well known in Samaria for their vice, for their pagan debauchery and corrupt religion. And so God then sent them Amos and Micah and Hosea and these prophets and told them to repent or they would go into captivity. But they didn't repent. And as a result, then, the Assyrian army came down and took them captive around 2123 to 21 range. So Assyria then had a three-part policy, which was fascinating throughout history. They were very well organized, where nations before that weren't. They were the first ones to conquer any peoples and become a world power, in a sense. But what they'd do is they would conquer a people, and then once those people were conquered, they would take tribute from them. If they rebelled, then they had a policy, and then they would then put their own vassal in there. They would go in there and put their own man, their puppet kings and stuff. They'd put their man in there, remove the leader, put their own man in there. If the people rebelled again, then they went in and they took those people out and put them in at this land and took the people from that land and put them into the land that they had conquered. That way, you understand, there wouldn't be any more rebellion because the people in the land, it wouldn't be their land anymore. And so there was nothing to really fight over. So it was quite brilliant in one sense. 2 Kings 17 gives this example here. Israel, of course, is a rebellious, and of course they rebelled against the powerful Assyrian army. So they put a vassal king up, they put their man in there, they rebelled again, and so they came down and they finally took the Israelites captive, and they moved them up to the area of Babylon, and they took some of the Babylonian peoples and move them down into the northern 10 tribes of Israel, this area that used to be called Ephraim. And 2 Kings 17 and verse 24 says this, "The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cutha and from Ava and from Hamath and from Sepharvaim and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and they dwelt in the cities thereof." And so what you had were pagan Babylonians now living down there in the land that used to be Israel's land. Well, God was pretty unhappy with this. So remember, historically, he actually sent all lions down there. Lions were attacking these people. They were having plagues. They were scared. And so they cried out to the king of Assyria, and they said, hey, we're upset with the people. I mean, the god of the land is upset with us. Now, their idea was that there were different gods. There was a god of the Persian land, and there was a god of Babylon, and there was a god of Assyria, and all the nations had their own gods, the gods of those lands. And so they thought, we've got to find out how to worship the god of this land, because if we don't, we're going to be eaten by all these lions that are attacking us. And so they sent for some help, and here's what happened. The king of Assyria sent a priest down to teach the people how to worship the god of that land. And when he did that, the plagues were assuaged. But you have to remember this. Were the priests loyal and faithful to God? No, they were corrupt. So what happened was they got a certain kind of teaching from a priest of God, but it was watered down. And then what they did, these people did, was they took the teachings that the priest gave them and they mixed them with their own pagan Babylonian system. And so they had a sort of syncretized religion that was partly God's and partly Babylonian, and it was kind of this mix, you see. And so in verse 32 and verse 33, here's what they had. So it says this after this, they feared the Lord and made unto themselves of the lowest of them priests of the high places, which sanctified for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord, and they served their own gods. Isn't that what we do today? Isn't that what we're doing today? You know, we fear God, but we do it our own way. And we've got these weird, you know, Christmas gods and the Ashtoreth and Ishtar and Nimrod and all that are the gods they're actually serving, but they're doing it saying they're fearing the Lord. So anyway, they do that after the manner of the nations whom they carried away. And it says, unto this day they do after their former manner. They fear not the Lord, neither do they do after his statutes or their ordinances, and so on. So you understand what happened here. These people were not Israelites. They were transplanted Babylonians who were taught pieces of God's law. They had the first five books of the law that the priest gave them, and they had a corrupt form of God's religion. And so what they'd do is, when it was to their advantage, they'd say, oh yeah, we're Israel, or we're Jews, and we have God's religion. And then when it wasn't to their advantage, they'd say, oh no, we're not. And so there was this hostility that sort of developed here. But as you remember then, 100 years later, Judah went into captivity. And they went to Babylon for 70 years, and then they were released from Babylon, and they were able to come back and rebuild that area of Jerusalem, and they built the wall. And so we read that in Ezra, and so on. Now what happened was, remember that the Samaritans were there, weren't they? They had been there for some time, and they said, let us help you do this. And the Jews said, we're not letting you help us. We have no part with us in this matter. And so now the hostility deepened and widened between these people, as it were. Now, as you remember, when we went through Ezra, that he said, look, we had made a mistake. We married foreign women. We married some of these Samaritans. And so we've got to put away our wives. So what happened then was they said, okay, we're going to put away our wives. The grandson of the high priest was married to Sanballat's daughter, who was one of the Samaritan leaders up there. So he says, I'm not putting away my wife. So what happens is Ezra says, then you have to go. So because he was the grandson of the high priest, he was in line to be the high priest. And so what he did was he took a copy of the law, and he went up to Sanballat, and Sanballat tells him, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll build you a temple. You don't need that temple down there. I'll build you a temple up here on Mount Gerizim. And Mount Gerizim, interestingly enough, was they considered, of course, the Samaritans considered this their holy place then. And they get this from the time when in Deuteronomy 27, when God was bringing the people in, he had them stand on Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, and he had some of the tribes on one mountain and some on the other, and he said these guys would give the blessings, and these guys would chant the cursing, see? And so they would hearken back to biblical precedent for this being holy. And then for that reason, they said that Mount Gerizim was a holy place, and that's where you're supposed to worship. So anyway, this is the kind of the background that existed here. And so there was this constant running competition. Do you worship at Jerusalem? Do you worship at Mount Gerizim? Who's the true people of God and who aren't the true people of God? And that same kind of hostility that you see in the Palestinians and the Jews today, it was running rife in the area. And this is why they just hated these people. But Christ, you see, was going to have to go up to Galilee. Now, there's only one way you could get there. You had to go through Samaria. Now, the Jews wouldn't do it. You know what they do? They go over to the Jordan, and they'd go along the Jordan River. They'd walk two or three extra days just to not have to go through those people's lands because they were so hated and so on. So anyway, these people were so hated that it was thought by the Jews if you shared a meal with them in your home, if you had food with them, that it would be the same as eating swine's flesh, to eat bread in their house. And so, you know, some of that kind of stuff is translated right on down to today in the Jewish thinking and in their mind. Anyway, that was the background and why these people were so hated. So let's go back to John and have a look at this. John 4 and verse 5 and 6. So, now then came he to the city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, therefore being wearied with his journeys, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. And the sixth hour is about 3 o'clock, of course. But now this city is interesting. You can imagine Jesus coming here from this standpoint and resting for a moment, that he had ties with this city that went back a long way. This was a very small village that had a well about a half a mile from a larger city called Shechem, or Shechem. And it seems to have been situated between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal here, about 40 miles from Jerusalem. Now, Sychar here means intoxicated. And, of course, this is the area that Ephraim came from. You remember what God called Ephraim? The drunkards of Ephraim, he would call them. And so it's very possible this city got its name from back from the time when they were there. But it was also the place where Abram stopped on his way to Haran. It was where God first appeared to him and where he first built an altar to him. So you can see Jesus sitting here probably reflecting on past history and the things that occurred at this very spot here. It was where he promised that that the land would be his seed. Anyway, it's generally thought, too, to be where Jacob also bought some land, and he built this well here in Genesis 33. It's where they say where Joseph was probably later buried. But anyway, Jacob's well was supposed to be here. It's not mentioned exactly in the Old Testament whether or not he did this, but it's thought that, you know, he bought this land. And it's thought that he did, but this well actually exists right there today. It's about 100 feet deep, but it's not from a fountain kind of well, but there is bubbling water, they say. And they say that there's a very large man-sized hole there, but there's no way to get water out of here without drawing it up somehow because it's very, very deep. So here it is about the hottest time. You know, we're talking about, what, 12 o'clock, is that right? Yeah, 6, that's right. I mean, I would say, yeah, 6, it would be 12 o'clock. So anyway, here it is nearing the hottest part of the day, and the scriptures actually make this comment. They tell us that Jesus was weary and that he was tired, and so he took some rest on the well here. And why would the scriptures take time out to tell us that? I really think the reason is because you got to remember the context of John. There were these Gnostic teachers that believed that Jesus wasn't physical. And so you understand, John takes opportunities from time to time to make specific comments to debunk this. He was tired. He got weary. He was human just like all the rest of us. God incarnate, yes, but his body got weary. And so I think what comes next is a very, very interesting teaching about prejudice. the Samaritans were so despicable to the Jews. And now here we have Christ going through Samaria. He's not afraid to go through Watts. He's not afraid to walk down town. He's not afraid of this. And he does so. But remember in chapter 3, he talks to Nicodemus, who was a social elite. And he tells him, basically, you can't have confidence in the flesh. You have to be born again. You have to be spirit. He doesn't say that to the woman here that he meets, because she already doesn't have confidence in the flesh and has no reason to, really. So now he's going to talk to this woman in Samaria, and he's going to talk in a whole different way. And you have to remember this. Not only were the Samaritans hated, what was the status of women in those days? Why, some, it is written actually in the Mishnah in certain places that a woman they didn't think had a soul. Of course, they realize they believe a soul and much in the immortality of the soul that the Catholic Church teaches. But they even thought that a woman didn't have one. And remember the prayers, one of the prayers that Mr. Kaplan said that you prayed and thanked God that you were a man, you know, every day. As crazy as it sounds today in our modern world. So you have to understand this. Here we have, how low can you go? The Samaritan, most despicable. And then on that, a woman. And even in their community, a rabbi never would talk to a woman in public. A rabbi would not lower himself to talk to a woman in public. And so here we have the chief rabbi, and he talks to this woman. John 4 and verse 7. There comes a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus said unto her, give me to drink. For the disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Then said the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. And so you can imagine this woman's shock. Wait a minute, here you are, a man, a Jew, and you're asking me to do a favor for you? Think about that. He's asking her to do a favor. Well, the Jews would never think to do a favor for a Samaritan. And so it's kind of a funny thing to do, but you can see what he's doing here, I think, that he wanted to see what her heart was like. Would she reject him? Would she rebel against him? Would she sort of chiding him or something, or become argumentative and so on? But I want to suggest something here. I think Christ knew what he was doing. And I'm going to speculate a little bit here, but I think he intended to meet this woman before she ever knew it was going to happen. That he seemed to be able to know what was going to be happening. But you understand, if you were, you know, Christ, would you just go to a place where there was antagonism, for one, and just let all your disciples go buy food? Or did he rather send them away to buy food, knowing that this woman was going to come? Would this woman have come if there would have been 12 or 13 Jewish men at that well? Probably would have hid for cover, wouldn't she, thinking, oh, they'll persecute me or something like that. No, I think that he probably sent them away so she wouldn't feel intimidated, so that she would come. I think that he was going to do something, a miracle in this woman's life, as it were, and he wanted her to feel secure and that she could come up here. And I want to say something, too, about this woman, and I don't know if it tells us that much of a story or not, but you understand, most of the time women would not go out at 12 noon to get water. But generally, they would go out in the latter part of the day, in the cooler part of the day, when you'd have to make the trip and carry heavy things back. And you get the impression, when you hear about the woman's character and her past life a little bit, that she might have been going there when no one else would be there. So that she didn't get hassled or bothered by other people in the town. It's a possibility anyway. So to me here, Jesus gives an example of the second commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself, because he met her needs in a way that was so different from the way he worked with Nicodemus. And I think this is important for us to understand. He talks to Nicodemus as one very high on the social ladder in a certain way. Now he's talking to a woman. He's talking to an outcast in the Jewish society, someone more on the bottom of the ladder. But here's what's interesting. Christ went to her where she was. See, he didn't condemn. He didn't open up and rip on her. It's very interesting how he approached this woman. And her response is interesting, too. So, again, he asks her this question, and she's asking, why would he ask this? And so he takes this as an opportunity to teach her some divine things. He absolutely dismisses the animosity between Jew and Samaritan. It's like it doesn't exist for him. He focuses on bigger issues. Isn't that sort of what we should be like? I think it is. To be like Christ. There's all kinds of issues that run in our world today. There's people on different levels economically, culturally, and so on, even spiritually. And we can tend to think we're superior. And that's what happened in their society. And this is what happens in ours in different ways. But anyway, my point is he never compromises his message. But he does change how he delivers that message. And he accommodates people and meets them where they are. So he knew her status socially. He knew it morally. But he didn't talk down to her. He didn't go to her as a critic. But he spoke to her actually as an equal. Can you imagine God speaking to a woman like this and just talking to her as though she was an equal and having respect for her? I think that he looks at people that way, that he has respect for everyone to a certain degree as God's children. And he isn't, cutting or mean to people. And he doesn't look down on them. And I think it's impressive about him where he says he's lowly, he's meek, and we can learn of him and we can take his burden and that kind of thing. Easy to talk to, not a respecter of person. So, okay, look, he knows your background, doesn't he? He knows everything we've done wrong, and yet he lets us come to him, doesn't he? And talks to us, and he has the respect to listen to what we have to say. It's an incredible being, just an incredible example of what we should be like. So anyway, when he addresses these two, there's a big difference here, a big difference. With Nicodemus, think about this. Here's a man who's named. And here's a woman with no name. He has a good reputation. She has a bad. He was wealthy. She was poor. He came to Jesus, but I see Jesus coming to this woman. One man is outstanding in society. One's an outcast in society. One is religious and morally right, and one isn't. One's worldly, carnal, and actually immoral. No immediate response from Nicodemus, interestingly. And this girl, she's going to have a huge response right away. When Nicodemus, he's talking to a powerful leader in his own right, he's blunt, he's direct, he's to the point. When he's talking with this woman, he's very tactful. He's kind of left of field, and he approaches her in an oblique way. With Nicodemus, he begins talking about the spiritual. With this woman that's carnal, what does he start talking about? Water, drinking, physical things, you see. Begins with the physical. And so he approaches each person in the way that they needed to be approached, sensitive to their needs and not his own. And there's a tremendous lesson here from this. And I say this in terms of this one point that I want to make, and I hope we come away with tonight, that the second commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you is what the saying goes. But here there's two levels to understand this on. One level is physical, and the other is spiritual. Now, let me show you what I mean by that. Jesus didn't go to her the way he wanted her to come to him, did he? He went to her the way she needed him to come to him. So I say this, like, you have to be married, I guess, to understand this, but if you do unto others as you want them to do unto you, you've got nothing but conflict, because men want to be respected and looked up to, be important, to be admired, you know. Women don't need that. They want to be romanced. They want to be cherished. They want to be the special object of that man's desire, you see. And that's what's fulfilling to them. So the point I make is that you can't fulfill you can't do for the other person what you want done for you. You can do that in terms of being fair, and you do that, you know, in a general sense, because we all have needs, and so we recognize other people have needs. But on a spiritual level, if we take that a level deeper, we try to understand that other person, and we go, wait a minute, I kind of like to be rough. You know how you and I can joke around, you can punch me? I take that as, you know, he's my friend. But you understand, I'm that way, but somebody else might not be that way. So if if I go around to everybody and I'm punching them and stuff and roughhousing, then some will be offended and some won't. And my point is that spiritually, the way to understand do unto others have them do unto you. The spiritual level is do unto others as they would want you to do unto them. And that takes a little bit more understanding. My point is, this is the kind of understanding that Jesus Christ exhibited here by way of example. Approaches Nicodemus one way, approaches this woman a totally different way. And so anyway, that's an important lesson, that everybody's different. And so you can't just say, well, this is the way I like it, and so now I'm going to treat them that way, because they might not understand that. So anyway, this is what Paul did, as you remember. He said, I became all things to all men. That he was careful in how he approached people. He wasn't coming down hard on people. He wasn't expecting everyone just to be like he was, because he was probably half a terror, you know, that guy. He was a tough man, I think. So anyway, Jesus comes to her, and he's easily entreated. And we see this in verse 10 as we continue the story here. Jesus answered, and he said unto her, if you knew the gift of God, who it is that says unto you, give me to drink, you would have asked of him, and he would have given you living waters. Well, when he says the gift of God, you might read in some commentaries, and they think that's the gift is the living waters. I don't think it is. When he says, if you knew the gift of God, and you look up this word, it actually means sacrifice. It implies sacrifice. If you knew what God was giving to you, this gift of the sacrifice of my life, then you would have asked me for living waters, and I would give them to you. Remember, he said that out of your belly shall flow rivers of living water. David said, as my soul pants after you, just thirsts after you, the way a deer who's exhausted pants as it comes up to the brook, just wanting a drink so bad. Have you ever been that thirsty when water, nothing but water, tastes so good? That's how we should be with God, I think. And even the Jews understood this by the word, if you're taking notes, is doria in the Greek. And it means gratuity, gift, present, sacrifice, or offering. So, anyway, the point is the Jews understood this, too, when he said this, to thirst for God. They understood that there was a thirst that man has. There's a sense that we're not fulfilled, are we? We try to be fulfilled in life. The advertising people tell us, buy this and buy that, and you'll be happy if you have this Mustang, if you have a big home, if you have these things. And so there's something that drives us in life, and we look for fulfillment, and we want that. And there's this something inside us that agonizes it, and there's a desire that doesn't seem to be fulfilled, and we try these things they tell us will fulfill us, and they don't. And we try other things in life, and we're always seeking. You remember that song that Katie Lang, I think it was, sang? Constant craving. You know, we have these constant cravings, but really, God is the one and only one that can really fulfill our deepest needs. And that's what we're really thirsting after. It's what he has to offer. And these other things are counterfeits, and they are distractions in our lives. So anyway, in verse 11, the woman said unto him, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then have you have this living water? So here we have a well that's about 75 or 100 feet deep. And in those days, people that traveled, they used to carried a pouch on a rope with them, because they'd come across wells, and the wells, you'd have to let it down, so that's the only way they could get drinks. So they always carried this, and he didn't have anything like this, so she was going, well, where are you going to get this water? And how are you going to perform what you said? And then he says something else to her in verse 12. I'm sorry. She says to him, are you greater than our father Jacob, which gave us this well and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle? So she's wondering, well, how are you going to do this? And who are you making yourself to be? It's kind of a challenge to Christ. Here this was Jacob's land, and the tradition was that he had either dug this well or found the well. And so he drank of this thing, and it was wholesome water and honored. And so they were saying this well was honorable. And so are you more able to find water than Jacob? Are you making yourself equal or better than Jacob, she's saying. And in this case, if you looked at it this way, it'd be like, well, are you more American than George Washington? You see, that's the approach that they were taking there. Are you a greater Catholic than the Pope? You know, how are you going to get better water than this here? So anyway, Jesus then answers. Excuse me. Jesus answered and said unto her, whosoever drinks of this water shall thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But that water I shall give him shall be in him a well of living water, springing up into everlasting life. And then the woman says to him, sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come here any more to draw. And so, you know, she again still thinks that he's talking physically. When I read this, I kind of think of the time when Peter says, oh, you should never wash my feet, remember? And then, well, if I don't wash it, then you have no part in me. Oh, well, just wash all of me then, you know, and that kind of attitude here. But, you know, oh, give me this water. Okay, I want that. And so anyway, people are thirsty, and they're looking for wells that are, and the scriptures say it this way, they actually say that people are looking for dry wells. Everywhere they go, they're not finding the satisfaction. And so Mick Jagger sings, I can't get no satisfaction because of this thing in us. But if Christ is saying this, he will never disappoint us. And I predict this, no matter how grand you think that kingdom's going to be, we are going to be blown away. God is the master of understatement. We're going to be so shocked when we see it. When we find out, you know, as it says, eye hasn't seen, ear hasn't heard what God has prepared for those that love him. We will be so surprised and awed that what he's offering us is never going to disappoint. It's not going to be less than we ever can imagine. It's always going to be better. So no matter when you are filled with God, when you are filled with the Spirit of God, as Randy talked about this week, then it doesn't matter if you're wet. It doesn't matter if you're too dry. It doesn't matter if it's too hot. It doesn't matter if the pressures at work are going on. It doesn't matter to you, because you have a fire and passion and a vision of something so wonderful that these other things don't compare by any stretch of the imagination. So she wants the water he's talking about, but she thinks it's the kind of water that's going to assuage her physical thirst. So Christ now stops the verbal jousting back and forth, and he lifts the curtain to show her something. And he lifts your curtain, and he lifts yours, John, and Debbie, and all of us. And you know what we see when he lifts the curtain? Ourselves. And that's what he does with her. John 4 and verse 16, Jesus said unto her, go call your husband and come here. And the woman answered and said, I have no husband. And Jesus said unto her, you have said well, I have no husband. For you've had five husbands, and he who you have now is not your husband. In that you said truly. So Christ says this to her for a couple of reasons, I believe. Another words, he wanted to get her to face herself and see her spiritual state. The sinner can't avoid their sin. You can't just go, well, you know, it's no big deal, and kind of sidestep it and go into God's church and into God's kingdom. And this is something, this is why we have to examine ourselves, isn't it, every year. What are we looking for? Well, those things that we slid by this year. We're looking for some of those. What have we been doing that we shouldn't be doing? And Proverbs 28, verse 13, he that covers his sins shall not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them shall have mercy of God. So another reason was to let her know her spiritual state, and that he was qualified to teach her spiritual things. And Jeremiah 23 and 24 says this, can any hide himself in secret places that I can't see him, says the Lord?
Do not I fill heaven and earth, says the Lord? We act like he doesn't see us, don't we? We do that sometimes. What we think, the things we say, the things we do. There's no hiding from him. We're just like exposed as she was, you know. He knows everything about us. We've got to come face to face with our sin and renounce it. And that's why the famous scripture in Acts says, repent and be baptized, and you shall receive your sins' forgiveness. They'll be blotted out when the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of God. So notice again the way he approached her. He didn't condemn her. He didn't act superior. And he was standing there before a woman who must have felt very, very vulnerable. You just looked inside me. You just told me you know what I've been doing. And she knew he was a rabbi. He knew about her life. She could have fled, but she stayed because of the way he approached her. Didn't confront her with her sin. He confronted her with herself. That's what he did. And then she dealt with her sin on her own level. And this is a lesson for all of us. When we approach others who have a sin, we should not be condescending or acting superior or condemning them. All of us have had our own sins. So try to understand their vulnerability. There are lessons in what confrontation with God produces. Every case God appears to a man, we end up seeing ourselves. Job said this, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear. Now my eye sees you. Isaiah said, woe is me, I'm undone, because I'm a man of unclean lips. And Luke says this, when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, I'm a sinful man. Isn't that what our confrontation with God always makes us see our wickedness by comparison to him? And we cannot see God until we first see ourselves. We've got to be able to see ourselves the way that God sees us. And this may be one of the most difficult things for us to do, because we run from it, we hide from it, we want to think of ourselves as being good. I've heard so many people say this, well, I'm a good person. I have no grasp. We're all good persons, aren't we? No. No, we're not. There's only one good. Only one. But we tend to think this way. That's part of our human nature. So he confronts her with the truth. She had five husbands and one was really not her husband that she was with. And she may have been cast off by these other husbands. And many of the Jews believe you could divorce for just about any reason. And perhaps some of those husbands could have died. It's possible. And she may have simply cohabited with others. But five husbands is quite a number. But her current man was not a legal husband. She wasn't married to him. And maybe she wasn't legally divorced from her other husbands. So now her attitude takes a turn. The woman says unto him, sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. And the woman had this gradual change of attitude towards him. And now she wants to know again, our fathers worshipped in this mountain. And you say that Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said unto her something very interesting. But you understand, they had a conflict. And their conflict of where was the right place to worship that they argued about would be like our 14th, 15th controversy. So if Christ was here, what do you think we'd be asking? That'd be one of the questions, wouldn't it? So she's asking him, well, where's the right place to worship? And then he says something that is so profound. Jesus says unto her, woman, believe me, the hour comes when you shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship, you know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. The hour comes, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeks such to worship him. God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. So here again, think about all of the church buildings that they build and how they have their crosses. I remember talking to one woman and she read the Christmas book and she said, "Well, Art, I love my pageantry." And, you know, I mean, this was her religion. And so she thought you had to go to a certain place and you had to have crosses and things like that to worship. And today people think similar things in terms of you have to be in this church or you have to be in that church. Can you see how this blows that whole concept out of the water? What is this really saying? Worship in spirit and in truth. You be sincerely seeking God in your life and worshiping Him wherever you are and at all times. And that's what God seeks. And the building has no real function that way. And so if people ask you, well, if you're going to keep the feast, you got to go to Jerusalem. No, I don't. I don't have to go to Jerusalem to worship God at the feast. Why? Because it doesn't matter where you worship. The quality is what He's looking for, isn't He now? The hour has come when you have the Spirit of God in you. You have a link like a telephone line going straight to God, and our worship goes through that Spirit and through that line to Him, no matter where we are. Cell phone, I guess, would be a good analogy. But there are people who refuse to, you know, worship in certain buildings, and I agree. I don't think it's a good idea to worship where there are images and so on that could offend people. I think that that's something we should steer clear of and keep our line real deep and dark there too. But on the other hand, I come back to, suppose you're arrested. Suppose you're put in jail. Suppose you're held captive in a Catholic church. Is that going to make a difference? No. No. So I think these are the famous words of Christ. I'd like to stop here. We'll pick it up and finish in the next chapter a little bit later. But I'd like us to give some thought to this this week about how to worship God in spirit and in truth. What is the meaning of that? And how do we do that? And we'll pick that up next time when we have another new moon. So I want to thank everybody for coming. I want to thank all of you who are listening. And I'll be looking forward to our next Bible study.